In the beginning, there was darkness, a void waiting to be filled with the echoes of destiny. From the depths of time, legends emerged. Heroes forged in the fires of adversity, their stories etched in the fabric of eternity. Through the sands of ancient deserts, across the vast expanse of galaxies, and amidst the tumultuous waves of the ocean, their journeys began. But amidst the chaos, there arose a whisper, a call to action, a beacon of hope. Now, as the world holds its breath, a new tale unfolds, a story of courage, of triumph against all odds. Join us as we delve into the depths of imagination, as we embark on a journey beyond the realms of possibility. For in every tale lies a lesson, in every legend, a truth waiting to be discovered. This is not just a podcast. This is an odyssey, a quest for knowledge, a quest for inspiration, a quest for the very essence of what it means to be human. Welcome, dear listeners, to a world of infinite possibilities. Welcome, dear listeners, to the True Life Podcast. About a gram earlier, just to, you know, just to get going.
Well, that's I microdose daily.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen.
Actually, welcome. I had ketamine shot yesterday, my monthly ketamine shot, and so I'm feeling pretty good, but I still have some pains. But at least I know where they come from now. And
that's right.
I'm
that's
off right. medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the True Life Podcast. I hope everybody's having a beautiful day. I got a great show for you today. The one and only Mark Rose, activist for cannabis, psychedelic law reforms, entrepreneur, founder of Grateful Meds. But beyond all of that, he's someone that embodies the spirit of activism. And I think in the world today, like I know myself, I look up to you, man. I see the things that you've done and I see the strategies that you use. And I think that the world we're in today, especially in the psychedelic scene, is really missing a little flavor of that. And that's why I want to reintroduce you to maybe some of the new kids coming up that may be looking for an avenue. Maybe some of the kids that didn't fit in or are looking for an avenue or see some injustice out there or see some, you know, want to push back a little bit. Like, I think that's a big part of this movement. And I think that you're a big part of that, Mark, in your career. And so I just kind of wanted to throw it to you to maybe introduce yourself and just ask you how you're doing, man. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm Mark Rose. I'm doing very well. I just had a ketamine injection yesterday. So, you know, I'm doing great. I guess I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, Rust Belt town. I left there about 1978 to join the Air Force and went to the medical squadron. But I got arrested for 4 flakes of marijuana and got kicked out. They didn't find the pound. And then I came to Boulder. And when I was young in the 70s in Toledo, my cousins were a lot older. So they were kind of hippies. And so I was turned on to that life at an early age and was very interested. Around 8, 9, 10, I was reading stuff about Leary, all that, you know. And then one time in, it was 1972, I was watching the news with my parents. And they said, oh, don't go to Cullen Park. It's a literal drugstore of marijuana and da-da-da-da. I excused myself and got on my bike and drove out to Cullen Park, rode out to Cullen Park.
Love it.
And, I was a paper boy. So I was looking for some marijuana, and I went up to this car that was from Michigan, and I said, hey, you guys got any marijuana? They said, no, but we have orange sunshine. And I said, what's that? And they go, LSD 25. I said, how much will $30 give me? And they just poured it into my hands. And I was like, I experienced that with friends. And a lot of them didn't have a positive experience from it. Maybe they just weren't ready. I don't know. We were very young. I got to say that. Maybe too young for some people.
Maybe.
But for me, being a survivor of sexual abuse as a kid, holding a lot of trauma, generational trauma, over and over, you know? LSD, mescaline, things like that, it helped me to cope. I was happy, you know? And before that, you know, I had psychiatrists experimenting in my brain at 10 years old. And every time I've ever taken a medication from a psychiatrist, it has flipped me out. And that happened to me just recently because I was trying to obtain esketamine. And the FDA, their wisdom, you know, says, oh, you can't prescribe that without also prescribing an SSRI medication. So, you know, they were putting me on an SSRI so I get approved for esketamine so I could kind of microdose between the peaks and valleys of the ketamine. And that just flew me out of my mind. And it's taken me about 3 months to regain that. And that's the problem with psychiatry, in my opinion, is they're experimenting. It's constant. And there's so many natural medicines to help us, you know. And you know, when I worked in medicine, the first, you know, and you know, no doctor, I was a technologist, that sort of thing. But the first thing you're always taught is the patient knows their body the best. And, you know, you just need to get a good history out of them. Medical world seems to have forgotten that. My last job was, you know, basically keeping mental health patients holds from escaping the emergency room. And I took that job kind of like as just to see what was going on in the hospital world again. And because I had been out of it for about 10, 15, 20 years, maybe. And I was appalled. I was appalled. The lack of compassion. The lack of compassion. And the injecting him with these drugs that just made him worse. And when every one of them, you know, I can't believe it. They're coming in suicidal. Why not give him a shot of ketamine? It takes away 100% suicidal ideations. It helps with depression 80% of the time. You know, these people could be walking out cured. Not cured, but helped. Helped. And because you always need, you know, the aftercare, the integration, all that. And which is something I'm just learning myself. And but you know, I got to give big props to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love that I consider bodhisattvas slash smugglers. And I thank these guys so much. I thank them so much because they were responsible for my first psychedelic experience. And, you know, they tried to turn on the world. And we wouldn't be here without them today with the psychedelic renaissance. And, but, you know, because they don't have degrees or they don't have this or that, they're being overlooked. And their wisdom is so great. And I think it's a shame. I just think it's a shame. And, you know, and I also want to give a shout out to my daughter. I'm going to be going to her graduation here out in Hayward. She's becoming a chiropractor specializing in women's health. So, anyway. Oh, and I'd like to acknowledge Tina Turner. May she rest in power. I've never seen a, she's got to be the most greatest example of a transformation of a human being in my lifetime. I am not kidding you. You know, going from sex, you know, sexual abuse, getting shot at, all that crap, you know, to becoming a Buddhist and being peaceful with it at the end. I listen to her sing sutras every morning.
I didn't know she did that. That's amazing.
She does. Or had.
Yeah.
She's got several videos on that. And, and that's just it. You know, a lot of people, some people can get there without psychedelics. Many can't. But they're just a tool in the tool belt, you know?
Right.
And you know, my motivation is the same when it was with cannabis back in 2009 or whatever, when I started going down the legislature and talking, whatever. You know, it's an injustice, man, to keep this stuff illegal. It's just an injustice. And, you know, this country grew hemp from the very beginning. The very beginning. Brought it back in World War I. Brought it back in World War II. You know, what is the deal, man? And then with psychedelics, they were, you know, Bill W. from Alcoholics Anonymous was advocating the use of LSD in the 1950s to cure alcoholics. You know, there's so much wisdom that we have lost.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all true. On the topic of Tina Turner, simply the best, right? I mean, she said it herself.
Absolutely.
The brotherhood, you know, what an amazing story, of which most people will only remember the words orange sunshine. But, you know, I'm sure that there are some, you know, storytellers around that could talk about some of the transformations that happened. And they themselves were like a trip. Like, they were the trip that changed people. They were the vehicle, sort of, right? Like,
they were spiritual warriors. They were spiritual warriors. And you know, I'm in contact with one of them quite frequently. Actually, I just bought a signed poster off of him. But
I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but and I'm just amazed, man, that these people's wisdom is just being overlooked. And it's got to do with corporate greed. Yeah. And that's what it's about. And I'm really afraid that the psychedelic scene is going to turn into what the cannabis scene turned into, which is a lot of pump and dump schemes, people losing a lot of money, oversaturated market, and boom, you know, a lot of dreams turn into nightmares.
Maybe you could talk about some of the similarities that you see. Maybe we should start off first with, let's talk about what happened in the cannabis scene, because you were there. You were on the ground floor when a lot of people came together and were, you know, maybe even trying to start a monopoly down there. Maybe you could start at the beginning there about the cannabis scene, and then you could walk it into what's happening with psychedelics today and what's similar about it.
I can tell you my story.
Sure, I love it.
I started, you know, I've smuggled cannabis my whole life and sold it. I, you know, at 17, I was going down to Florida and running, you know, bagos back for my cousin, you know. You know, after the Air Force, when I came to Boulder, I fell into this crazy, crazy organization where, like, you know, and traveling all across the country. That was my gig. And even when I started the, you know, regular jobs, when I take a vacation, that's what I did. You know? And but then legalization happened, or no, we call it legalization. Yeah, the constitutional amendment. I think it was Amendment 22, that, you know, went into effect in 2001. So, but it was pretty underground at that time. People were growing. You know, you had to know somebody, you had to get this license. There was one place to get it, and it was this older doctor, forgive me, I forget her name, but she's so wonderful. And she was out of Westminster, and it was a group out of Oregon that began that. And then, you know, I was growing for people and doing my thing, you know, as I usually do. And then two other dispensaries popped up, one in Colorado Springs, one in Boulder. And I grew for the one in Boulder, and you know, and they were doing a great job and everything. But then we had this meeting down in Denver, high rise in Denver, lawyer's office, you know, the guys that passed Amendment 64 were there, representatives, I imagine, for the legislature, about 30 of us growers, you know, basically creating, you know, they could have arrested us on a RICO charge, man. We were conspiring to grow all the cannabis for Colorado. And they wanted to make a monopoly. And I said, I objected. And there was another thing involved too. They were bummed out about my past because, you know, we all submitted our arrest records and this and that. You know, I got set up in the 80s, man. You know, I got set up like a bowling pin. I'm not kidding. And then I got busted again, you know, driving through Nebraska one time. But, you know, such is life. So they were kind of like, oh, you know, what do you got to give to this? And I go, you know, then they're like, are you adverse to money? I go, no, I'm not adverse to money, but I'm adverse to injustice. Mm. And they said, well, what the hell are you going to do about it? I said, you'll see. And the very next week, I opened up Grateful Meds in Netherland, Colorado. And then started debating Boulder County's DA through the front page. And that turned into more, you know, press, which turned into bigger press. And, you know, it just grew and grew. Interviews in High Times, you know, mention in Rolling Stone, that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, a lot. But the problem was, I was the only dispensary owner that was down there fighting for patients' rights. Oh, no, I can't say that. There was Josh Stanley, who created Charlotte's Web. And actually, he asked me to partner up with him because we were kind of on opposite sides on, like, regulations and stuff. I wasn't big on the greed factor, you know? And I turned it down, you know? And they kind of won that side, you know, where, you know, our regulations didn't. Before that, because how it ran, at first, it was a caregiver system. So you had to have, you know, people would write over a caregiver slip. You know, I had hundreds of people, you know, maybe even more than hundreds. Because I had people coming from Durango, all corners of the state, man. Because what I was doing, I had pretty much everybody in the town of Netherland growing cannabis for me. And so I had 100 strains at one point on my shelves. People would just come to see it or see the signed Grateful Dead guitar, you know? You know, it was crazy. And it was a fun time. You know, the state decided on the model, instead of sharing the wealth, they decided on vertical integration, which goes back to Henry Ford, where you own everything. You know, everybody, seed to sale, got to track it, seed to sale. Which cuts out a lot of side businesses, you know, in the beginning. And then, of course, they voted to kick me out. And I think about 1,000 other people that had similar records, you know, and, you know, Claire Lovey, she was the head of the Senate back then. I consider her a friend today. Even though she voted against me then, she called me 2 years later and said, Mark, we fixed it. You can get back in now. I'm like, well, Claire, with all this regulation and stuff like that, you know, you got $1 million to lend me? And she's like, I'm so sorry, Mark. And I go, yeah, you know, maybe someday I'll call in a favor.
Yeah.
And she's my county commissioner now. But a good person, great person. And the vertical integration thing, you know, what that did is it just created, you know, the pioneers that came in that really were doing the work, they all got bought out or went out of business. Big money, bigger money came in. Now even bigger money's come in. And soon it'll be pharmaceutical, tobacco, you name it, beer companies. It's going to happen. And I hate to see it. I really do.
Yeah, that's the model that, you know, it's this form of centralization. And, you know, it's, I don't know, it's almost sometimes like the very seeds of destruction are planted in the creation of it. You know what I right. mean? And well, but it's interesting, because do you see some similar patterns now that you've been through that, and not only been through it and seen it, but participated in it? Now we're seeing this next wave of like psilocybin, which is similar to cannabis in a lot of ways, and that absolutely. It's relatively cheap to grow, and there's not a whole lot of regulations around it. And there's already this cannabis model that a lot of money interested to have found ways to, you know, get their hooks in or manipulate or change. Do you see something similar that could happen to like the psilocybin or the psychedelic industry?
I absolutely do. And if it does, it's going to be a disaster. Mm. You know, it needs to be done correctly. You know, right now in Colorado, we can share psilocybin with each other at cost. It's our right now. DMT, mescaline, iboga, which, by the way, I went through the whole opiate thing. I fell 150 feet off a Navajo peak in Colorado. Made a wrong move. My friends say 500, but I kind of tumbled like Bullwinkle down this avalanche chute. And luckily, my pack cut a rock and stopped me before I was going off this 1,000-foot cliff into the watershed. I literally saw my life flashing behind, you know, my eyes, that sort of thing. Wound up, you know, getting surgery, all that stuff. At first, I was getting raw chiropractics, maybe a little bit of Lorset for the pain. But then my VO retired because him and his wife broke up, right? So he went and had to get himself together. One of the best doctors I've ever known, Nathan Josephs. And anyway, they put me on, I went to a pain clinic, which as a doctor I worked with at Boulder Community Hospital. And I was probably one of the first patients put on OxyContin. And I didn't realize how badly it's affected my life for a long time. As far as anger, as far as a lot of different things. I've been given all these medications that now I realize that I'm off opiates. I was given them to treat the side effects of opiates. And, you know, opiates have their place. But let me tell you, for anybody out there who's like on methadone or Suboxone or anything like that, because I was and I had to go in the hospital, they're going to treat you like crap, my friends. They're going to treat you like crap. And the other thing is they're going to under-medicate because all your opiate receptors are screwed up. So you got to get off this stuff. And that's why what I did is I'm involved with that Purdue lawsuit, bank, you know, their deal. They appealed. I'm also involved with the Mallinckrodt pharmaceutical lawsuit. They did not appeal. So I'm waiting on a settlement. I plan to use that money to start an iboga retreat here in Colorado, if I can, and do it right. Because, you know, there needs to be medical monitoring. You got to have screening. ACLS training, therapists, a lot of aftercare. So it's going to take a bit. But nobody else will do it because there's no money, you see, because you know, it takes a lot of time to go through this, you know, and sure, you can fly down to Mexico, you go up to Canada and pay 10 grand, whatever, man. Like, I want to give it to the people that need it, you know, that can't afford it, you know, even if I have to give it to them for free.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, how do you set up a model like that, though? Like, is there a way I think that a lot of people would agree with you that the people that need some of the psychedelic medicine the most, the people that can't afford it.
Correct.
But how Have you any ideas of how to, you know, orchestrate a plan to get the people that need it the medicine? What do you think?
Well, for one, there's been an underground Ibogaine community, or which is derived from Iboga, since the 1960s, late 60s. So it's not like it's not around. It's just we got to bring it to the surface. Mm. Just like when I told back at the state legislature, which cannabis, I said, you know, let it, you know, there's this billion-dollar industry that's under the table. You know, let us bring it above the table, give you your cut, and come out of the shadows and be the good citizens that we really are. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing, man. You know, why are we being judged to just trying to feel better? I don't get it. And this drug war, you know, my cousin spent almost 16 years, I think. You know, I got another cousin that spent over six hits LSD that I gave him. That's some heavy karma.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel so bad for him. But, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You know, and it's just because of the laws are so different in each state. You know, if he would have got busted out in Colorado, they probably would have just laughed it off. You know? But here, or out in Ohio, you know, 6 years in prison. Because he was in the wrong county.
Yeah, you know, there's a war on drugs, but there's not a war on poverty. There's a war on drugs, but there's not a war on community. You know, it does seem to me that if people, and I think Colorado, Oregon, Canada, like these places are beginning to be sort of a beacon of light, because I think the states are starting to say, wow, we can really generate some revenue from here. But there's pushback too. If like the pharmaceutical industry is an industry, you could make the argument that addiction is an industry. They like to, in my opinion, I think there's a lot of people that see the addiction model as a, you know, just, it's like a conveyor belt. The person gets better and they get back on. Oh, you can't have any drugs at all. Here's a little bit. You're back on it.
Absolutely. Well,
you get someone with Iboga, all of a sudden you can wipe them. You can take them out of there. But there's a lot of moneyed interests that want people on that treadmill. It's creepy.
Absolutely. I went through a rehab.
Yeah, maybe you can share that.
One of the first ones in Boulder. It was called A Day at a Time. I was working at Rudy's Bakery, who honored Swami Rudrananda. And, you know, I went to and these people, they had the most, I always thought they were high on acid because they just had love in their eyes all the time. And I went to this guy and I said, man, you know, I got this problem with cocaine. He hugged me and took all that fucking pain and put me into a rehab, paid for it. And, you know, went through it and it was just a joke. And, you know, and then I tried it another time and I told him, you know, I went in, and this is a good story. I went in, and I literally freaked out of my mind, like psychosis, right? I walk right up to the psych ward. I ring the bell, and they go, yes? I go, let me in. I got a gun.
Let me in. That's so crazy.
Let me in. I got a gun. And I did. And suddenly, you know, the security comes, and they let me in. And he says, well, can I have your gun? I said, absolutely. I don't want it. I said, I'm just fucking scared.
Yeah.
And I need help. And then they asked me for my insurance. I said, oh, well, it's Anthem. I didn't have insurance. So 3 days, they come to me again. Mark, you don't have Anthem. Oh, shit. It must have been this one.
Yeah.
You know, a couple more days. Then they come again. Mark, you don't have. Must be this. Oh no, man. I go, you know what? I don't even care. It's been 7 days. I'm back to myself. I'm healthy. I'm in my right mind. And you people are no better than the cocaine dealers. You're making a profit off of people's freaking misery. And I truly believe that.
Yeah, it's there's I think there's good people that are trapped, like on both sides. Some of the people that have an addiction are trapped, and I think that there's professionals that have maybe never done drugs before but are trying to help people with drugs, and so they believe all the propaganda that was taught to them. Right. You know, they probably have a big heart and are like, oh man, I gotta help this person, I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
But they're not. Well, yeah, go ahead.
I agree, because you know, like with the people that are being trained right now in MDMA therapy, part of that, to become that, they have to take MDMA and experience it.
Yeah.
And I think that should be true with anybody that's guiding anybody in the psychedelic, that they need to be experienced with it so they can explain what's going to happen to this person, you know, and to explain that, you know, you can have a bad trip, but, or a really good trip. It's all in your mind. It's like the way you take it, man. And set and setting, so important, you know? You know, I'm usually more comfortable with it out in the nature, mm-hmm. woods, or with family at a Grateful Dead concert.
Yeah, there's something to be said about, you know, who you're surrounded by. And I think that is it's a good metaphor, because you know, your set and setting can not only influence your experience on a trip, but it also experiences the way you move through life. Like if we look back at our times when we were at our worst, we were probably around people that were probably pretty not that good, you know, or we were in a bad spot in our life, or we were living with a toxic roommate, or, you know, we were in a bad set and setting. So I think that method is something that transfers throughout life, whether you're taking a trip on mescaline, LSD, mushrooms, or you're taking a trip to Hawaii. You know, it's that set and setting.
Well, here's the thing is I was not always a good person. duality.
Sure.
Through my teenage years, I was happy man, because, you know, mescaline's around, acid, this, that. I'm medicating myself. And then suddenly it disappeared. Cocaine came on the scene. Mm. Me and my cousin basically were given a pickle jar full of cocaine by the Colombians as a gift. Within 2 years, 3 years, we were broke. Mm. We had lost everything. They also robbed us when we, you know, got a big load. Luckily, we sold most of it. But they had hired a crew from Detroit to come down and rob us. And literally, I 45 the back of my ear at 16 years old, and I watched my cousin's sister's teeth get kicked out across the room because she wouldn't keep her head down. We had to pay all that money back, and so the drug world, man, you know, it's dangerous. We gotta end this freaking war. Because, you know, the greed, the bullshit. Look at Portugal. Mm. Like, look at Portugal. They've legalized everything, and their drug problem is going away. It's going away. Nobody wakes up and says, you know what? I'm going to be a junkie. You know, they're recruited into it by someone. They're recruited into it. And a lot of it is they're recruited into by someone that needs a fix. And, you know, and it keeps going on and on. And, you know, and the worst fucking dealers are the goddamn physicians that were sitting there poisoning us with Oxycontin. For instance, I went to a Mapleton pain clinic in Boulder. They took me from 30 milligrams a day of oxycodone to 180, 300 milligrams of morphine. Then throw some Soma on top of that, and had me like that for a few years. And I'm working and doing my thing, you know, because that was their theory. You could be on high doses of opiates and live a normal life. Well, then in 2017, when the heat came down from the federal government, said, Mark, we're sorry, we're closing down. You got to find a new doctor. For a doctor to prescribe that, it was a year's waiting list. Any doctor in freaking Colorado. So they let 5,000 patients strung out. What do you think happened? Heroin is very cheap.
Yeah.
Heroin is very cheap. And it's a freaking epidemic, man, that we need to cure. We need to cure it. And a lot of that, again, goes back to psychedelics. Because, you know, me getting off of methadone, if it wasn't for ketamine, if it wasn't for psilocybin and a really intense LSD trip, I don't think I could have done it. I really don't. And the other factor was when I had the DVT, when they put a PICC line in my bicep to shower it with a clot-busting medicine, right?
Mm.
And after the anesthesia wore off, I was in severe pain. And they would come in and give me 10 milligrams of morphine. Well, I'm on, like, what, 150 milligrams of methadone. So it's not doing a damn thing for me. It lasts 5 minutes, and I'd cry for 2 hours. Give me another shot. Cry for 2 hours. They made me do that all night. Instead of the nurse calling a doctor and saying, you're patient is severely under-medicated, because that's how it used to work. That's how it used to work, but not anymore for some reason. And it's the stigma of opiate addiction, the stigma. And we got to change that. We really do. If we're going to get, past this, you know? And I think psychedelics plays a big part in that. I think spirituality plays a big part of that. You know, I never, you know, my whole life, I never really believed in God. You know, I got introduced to the Rudranandas in the early 80s. I went and meditated in their ashram and whatnot. And the Swami, like, plugged into my consciousness, right? And it freaked me out. It freaked me out. And I left, right? But who knows what he put in there, you know? and I'm glad he did. Because now I'm coming back to that, man. You know? And realizing that, you know, there's a better way. There's a better way, and a peaceful way. And but you got to push back, though. You can't be a victim. You can't be a freaking victim. You know, you got to push back.
Yeah. What do you think? Like going through what you saw with cannabis, or even seeing the previous resurgence of the psychedelic, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, or maybe even the late 50s, what do you think is different this time coming around?
America's consciousness, the world's consciousness, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think people like Deepak Chopra, you know, of course, Rick Doblin, and others have really helped that. You know, it's, I just think that America's realizing that something is really freaking wrong. And again, you know, Gabor Maté, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's got this new book, The Myth of Normal.
Hmm.
And I'll tell you what, it's so profound. And it explains so much about why our society is so messed up. And, you know, and I don't know. I just really hope that we can get ourselves on the right path. You know?
Yeah, I think we are, but it's, you know, I once heard a quote that said, nothing ever gets better until you admit that something's wrong. But yes. In the United States, look, we don't want to admit we're wrong. Like, we have a real problem with that. Like, if you admit you're wrong, you might get in trouble. If you admit you're wrong, you might lose your job. If you admit you're wrong, then everything else is wrong. Your relationships, it's really hard to do, but we have to do that.
Yeah, because, you know, you're stigmatized for that.
Yeah.
You know, or belittled, or whatever term you want to use, you know? And, you know, I can't remember who the quote was from, but something like, you know, correct a fool, he will hate you. Correct a wise man, he will appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, you know, and unfortunately, I think a lot of it had to do with the dumbing, what I call the dumbing down of America. you know, back in my day, we learned civics, social studies. We learned about the Constitution, history, and, you know, I was big on that, you know. And today, you know, in a lot of places, it's not even taught because they don't want you to know the tools on how to get things done, you know. And the real way to get things done is you go to your legislature with the law already written. Basically, you give it to them, make some improvements. Here's my idea. And that's kind of how it works, man. And do the work for them. You know, be assertive, you know, and it helps.
Yeah, it does seem like a different time we're in. You know, if you look at all the corruption that has kind of made its way through the veins of the American body, you can see places dying. And I, you know, whether it's low income neighborhoods, whether it's, you know, border towns or white communities in all over the world, communities all over the world are, or at least in the United States, like there's epidemics of fentanyl, there's epidemics of poverty. And these to me just seem to be epidemics of corruption. Like they're all symptoms of the sickness that is plaguing us. And it's this idea that unless we help each other, we're never going to make it through. We can run and we can hide, but the truth is, we are all sick. The society we live in is making us sick, and we have to stand up together and fight arm in arm, whether you're black and white or gay or straight or trans or whatever, man. Like, it's not that person over there. It's not that guy. It's not that girl. It's not that minority. It's all of us, and we're all guilty, and there's people that are making a conscious decision to divide us so they distract us while they take all the money. That's what, well, I think, man.
I can give you a good example of that.
Please.
I used to rent from this billionaire around here. I'm not going to name names so I don't get, you know. And when I was in a jam, he suggested I go see a realtor friend of him to kind of sell my home, right? And when I called the guy, I acted like I was the billionaire's best friend. And the guy opened up and, like, you know, it started, yeah, chat. Because I'd known him for years, you know.
Yeah.
And when we met at the house, you know, he's like, oh, it'd be great to get this, like, you know, a cheap house, you know, this, you know. I'm thinking to myself, I'm living at 10,000 feet bordered by national forest. What cheap house, you know? And what he was trying to do is skim my equity, you see? And then, but he told me the story that how him and this guy meet every morning to decide, and he uses the billionaire's money to buy up inventory of houses, and they hang on to them until the prices go up.
Yeah.
And then they sell. And this is the problem in America. This is why everybody's homeless. You know, freaking greed. You know, it's just, it's out of control, man. That whole mindset of all those, call them the CU Republicans back in the early 80s, you know, their mindset that greed is good, that Gordon Gekko crap.
Yeah, right. You know,
it's like, my God, man, it's never good. It's right. Never good. You know, like, when do you feel the best? You know, is it when you're stealing from somebody or when you're giving them something? You know?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, I agree. And I see this awakening as, if you look around the world, or if we just take the US, for example, there is a lot of people that are like, you know what, I'm not going to go work for this large corporation. And you know, whether it's there was a recent strike with the railway systems, UPS is getting ready to strike. A lot of these large multinational corporations that at one time were headquartered in the US are having a difficult time, like Amazon warehouses. They're having a difficult time finding people. And they try to blame the people, like, oh, well, they just don't want to work or they're lazy. But the truth is, maybe the people should get a fair shake at what the corporation's making. You know, it seems to me there's been this ever narrowing conveyor belt of profit going strictly to the top and then getting rid of the people on the bottom. And there's solutions, like, if we bring in automation, why not tax the robots? Okay, Amazon now has 3 million robots working on the floor. All of them should pay a payroll tax, every one of them. And that money should go into like a freedom fund. And right. that funds everybody to help build this country. There's a plenty of ways we could split things up.
Well, that's the thing, is why everybody's so depressed and anxious. Yeah. We're basically Uncle Sam's money-making machines.
Totally, yeah.
And, you know, I was working for a multinational corporation here when I got hurt for Jam Smuckers, and who basically own a lot of different things. You would be amazed. And, you know, they built a billion-dollar factory out here to make peanut butter jelly sandwiches without crust. Like, how lazy is America become? You know? I mean, it just blows me away. And here's the thing about, you know, in Eisenhower's time, you know, after you made your first $1 million, you were taxed 90% on the next million or whatever, right? And people lived pretty freaking good back then that were millionaires, okay? Then, you know, Kennedy cut it a little bit. It was like 50%, I think. And, you know, then, like, you know, Reagan cut it down to like 20s, you know, right. and we're like, you know, we're taking away our money. And when it comes to CEO pay, back in when I was starting out, you know, the executive or the CEO made 100 times more than, say, the janitor. Right. Now it's about 4,000 times more. Why is that? The janitor's still making the same thing. And here's an example. Out of high school, I hired into Jeep Corporation in Toledo, Ohio. 2019, I hired into JM Smuckers at the same pay rate.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a long time. So, you know, what are we doing? We're basically creating this this class of haves and have-nots. And, you know, back in when I was growing up, my family was rare because both my parents worked, but everybody else was living on one salary, you know? And it's amazing, you know, and people got by great. And what happened to that, you know? And I think it slowly started in 1968, and it's just this gradual, like going towards almost fascism. And we're pretty much here, folks. You know, it's like,
totally.
We gotta fight it, you know? And it's not because, you know, who's gonna win this, you know?
Nobody.
And people, again, it's expanding our consciousness.
Right.
You know, like Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, they're all, they used to have a board that would say, like, how quickly the world would become enlightened, right, after LSD, but it involved dumping it into the water system, right? and I, you know, and like, hey, you know, drop acid, not bombs.
Yeah, you know? I love it. I love the shirt.
And I believe in that. I really do, man. It's... You know, and it's not like you got to take it every day. You know, some people, you just got to take it once.
Right.
You know, and just realize you're part of a bigger thing, man. You're part of like the synchronicity of the whole world, everything, man. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest revelations I think people have on psychedelics, is this idea that maybe you didn't come into this world, you came out of it and you're part of it. And the people you see, you're part of. The tree that you see, you're part of. The earth you see, you're part of. And once you begin to really grasp that concept, the idea of greed kind of falls away, because it's like you're stealing from yourself. Like, you're making yourself worse by taking something that doesn't belong to you. Right. You know, it's interesting. And I think that is where we're at right now. Like, there is this sort of race between, you know, consciousness and catastrophe. And are we going to wake up fast enough, or is that wave just coming over? You know what? It's interesting to think about.
I heard Deepak say that we're at a crossroads right now. We can like sleeply be asleep and walk to extinction, sleepwalk into extinction, or we can awaken.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that. You know, we are there. But I also believe that they're not going to win. I think we're hearing the last gasp of the dinosaurs.
And, I love it.
You know, they're trying, they've been robbing our treasury for what, 40, 50 years now. You know, and their last gasps and all this stuff, these billionaires, you know what? We're going to get rid of these robber barons too. You know, because that's the problem with the world is we, all these oligarchs that are, you know, basically just ripping everybody off. You know, there's enough resources where we could feed everybody on the planet. We could, like, you know, there's enough resources here where we could give everybody a salary where they could live. You know, it's just amazing to me that what we spend our money on. A freaking war. War. That is our goal. And why? So America's got some heavy karma, man. And I think that's what's happening right now. And, you know, we got to get rid of that karma. We got to listen to people. Like, you know, the indigenous folks from every country, their wisdoms, man, are just so profound. And for us Westerners to try to rip it off, it's just, it's bullshit. And it just makes me mad, you know? You know, peyote ceremonies should be left for the people that have been using them for millenniums. You know, unless you're invited into it. You see what I'm saying? If you're invited into it, that's a good thing. But like to go and start like harvesting peyote and do this and that, you're just depleting it, man. And it's not a good way. If you want to experience mescaline, there's ways to do that. It's easy to make.
Yeah, there is plenty of ways to experience different things. And, you know, when we speak about the wisdom of our elders, one thing that I see missing, at least where I grew up, is this absence of rites of passage, this absence of rituals. You know, it used to be, that's the thing that the communities brought together. And you know, you can still hear echoes of like a quinceañera or a bar mitzvah. There's still some little echoes of these things, but maybe sort of a new, and maybe that's one thing I hope to see. And I do see it emerging in the psychedelic community is people beginning to bring together community events where people can experience a transition. Maybe the first time they see somebody go through it, and then it's their turn to go through it. And then they're the facilitator. It's like they get to go all the way around this wheel. And as soon as one person makes it around, now the next generation can make it around a little bit better. And so like, I see the wheel beginning to turn a little bit. What do you think about that?
I totally agree. And for instance, with Iboga, in the country where it's comes from in Africa, it is a rite of passage to become an adult. You take Iboga. They also use it for sicknesses and things like that. I think we've lost that whole thing as far as, you know, these rites of passages and like that. And I think they're very important. I really do. I I'm glad that, you know, my child experienced a psychedelic.
Sure.
I'm very glad. I made sure that when she, you know, I talked to her about drugs very early. I mean, from the time she was probably four, about, you know, not don't do this, don't do that, you know.
Yeah.
She got in high school, of course, you know, there came a curious time. Sure. And their friends all wanted to do acid, you know. And I was like, don't go buying it. Like, you know, if you guys really want to do this, you know, let me make sure it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they all had a good experience. And I don't think they've ever done it since. But, you know, it was up on my property, up in the woods, the proper setting.
Yeah.
You know, and a person there that wasn't stoned to take care of them. And they had a great time. So, you know, it's, and what did it hurt her? I mean, she's, like I said, she's graduating to be a chiropractor.
Yeah.
And, you know, and think of all the things, like with technology, you know, the human genome, mm-hmm. all that, that we're all like seeing, like, while on LSD.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah. In some ways, the war on drugs is almost like a war on consciousness, because it Absolutely. Forces us, like, every, you can make the argument that every country runs on drugs. We happen to run on caffeine, stimulants, and alcohol.
That's
and these
right.
are drugs that make you be quote unquote productive. Like, you know what I mean? Like, whatever that's supposed to mean, whatever yeah. sort of value productivity is, you know, it saddens me to think, but you can go to any union hall, any break room in any store in any mall, and there's a coffee machine there. Like,
absolutely.
You know, what if we replace the coffee machine with some mushroom tea? You know, what happens when we start changing the fuel that we run on? Well, I think we're beginning to see. Yeah, exactly. We're beginning to see this outbreak of consciousness. We're beginning to see this outbreak of forgiveness, this all of a sudden overwhelming feeling of respect for the planet. Like, and, you know, it makes the people that own all the rights to everything really nervous when all
does.
Of a sudden, you know, and that's good. That's how it should be. These people right. should be given the opportunity to apologize and pay some sort of penalties, or, you know, if they can't do that, then the consequences for them, I think, are going to be dire. You know, I'm amazed that the Sackler family isn't facing the death penalty right now, in my opinion. Like, I think that they should be facing a jury of their peers, and they should be forced to, you know, see the pools of tears that their drug has caused to people in order for them to be so wealthy. Like, it's such a disgusting display.
And they knew it all
they
along.
Knew it.
They knew it they knew all it. Along. That's why I'm involved in that suit.
Good.
You know, and it's terrible. And, you know, and Mellicrot was even worse, because when OxyContin had to change their formula so it couldn't be tampered with, mm-hmm. that's when Mellicrot, an Irish pharmaceutical company, decided, oh, I want a piece of this action, and created, you know, the typical blue pill now with the M that yeah. is fake fentanyl now, but was Roxycodone. Mm. And I've got evidence that, you know, they were sent, you know, hyping up the doctors. They had this like reggae song, you know. You've got the power in your hand, man. You can get them out of pain. You know, like the script pad in the hand, yeah. get them out of pain. It's just like, my God, man. These marketing campaigns
yeah.
to addict people.
Yeah.
To addict people. And why are the drug companies on TV talking people into like buying some drug that they don't need?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And, you know, it's taken me a lot of years to understand this, because working in medicine, I kind of believed it for a sure. long time. I really did. And I still believe in a lot of it, like sleep medicine, things like that. But it's been perverted by the drug companies. It's been perverted. And not only them, we need to get the DEA out of healthcare. I'm serious. Like, they're a rogue organization. You know, who the hell are they to say what your doctor can prescribe you or what he can't? You know, it's ridiculous. That's why we have the FDA, you know? And to me, the DEA should be abolished immediately. You know, they're the worst, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting to see how many people, like, even on the FDA, there's a revolving door, the same that happens in our Congress, the same that happens with lobbyists. You know, how many representatives from Pfizer came from the FDA, and how many go back and forth? It's just, hey, you pay me, I'll approve your drug and we'll test it on the kids.
That's, you know, how, like, it works.
It's so crazy, man.
It's how it works.
It's not that much different than Nazi Germany, if you think about it, like the same way they were testing on stuff, but now they're just making more money and they've legalized it.
Well, you know, and a lot of those drugs that were developed in Nazi Germany, we use them. You know?
Yeah, it's true. We never stopped.
Methamphetamine, all that kind of crap. Yeah. It's a bad situation, but I think the worst situations is, this whole thing with the SSRI medication and trying to screw with serotonin receptors and dopamine receptors and things like that. Because, they only block or, release, or now they've got new ones where it's like a little floodgate, they say. It's like bull.
Yeah.
I say bull.
Yeah.
And how much do they help? Maybe 30% of the people.
Maybe 30%.
Maybe, exactly. where, again, ketamine, it's been shown to help, I think, well over 50%. I think it's closer to 80%.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work for everybody, but it's one hell of an experience, I'll tell you that. And if you really want to go and see what the void or whatever you want to call it, I had a experience on ketamine, the complete loss of ego. I felt like I was going down the chute, like down a slide, 300 miles an hour, right? Scared the hell out of me. All of a sudden, I'm just shot out into this universe. And, I realized it's like so great. And that's when I started believing in God. I really realized it. And it was amazing. The worst part about it, though, is I had all these revelations and I came back and I didn't go and talk to somebody to integrate that. What a freaking lost opportunity. Because ever since I've gone to ketamine therapy, I've always tried to go back to that and I can never get it. When they asked me how was it, I said it's when my first time I went to it, the therapy, because my first time I did ketamine where I had that experience, I got it myself and a vial of it and injected myself with 125 milligrams an amazing experience. But of course then ketamine clinics didn't open up for about 3 or 4 years after that. So when I went back, went to a ketamine clinic, the first session they asked me, how was it? I said, it was like seeing a friend's hand, but I couldn't quite grasp it. And
that's a great
And that, I know several ex and current police officers that are in ketamine therapy. I think every police officer should be in ketamine therapy. I'm not kidding you. Because we have a real problem with law enforcement in this country. I'll tell you an incident. When I was 14, me and my friends were beaten by police for standing on a corner, which was kind of in front of my own home. Beaten. One of my friends, or two of them, were thrown in the paddy wagon, and they just emptied a can of Mason. And my one friend broke out, knocked the cop down, and ran. The other one thought he was going to be a good person and sit there, and he got the hell beat out of him all the way down. And in Toledo, when you went up, you used to have to go to this elevator up when you got booked. That elevator they kept blood all over it just to freaking intimidate you. And this is the mindset of law enforcement still today. We're the enemies. We're not the enemies. You're supposed to be our servants. You're supposed to protect us and serve, and not harass us and kill us. When I was set up, in the early 80s or late 80s, I got off because, you know, they were trying to bust us for the pot deal, but they played on the cocaine weaknesses. Mm. And they had a snitch paid informant. I hired him in my tie-dye shop. Okay. And I told him, I said, if you're my friend, you'll never break cocaine out around me because I've got an issue. He kept asking me about pot. I said, oh, maybe I can get you a bag. Oh, I need 10 pot. Oh, I can't get that kind of weight, you know, because you don't crap where you sleep, right? And he worked on me for about a year. Then one day, and they moved him right in next to me in these cabins. And one day we pull up on this mountain road, and he says, Mark, I need to borrow your scale. I said, why do you need my scale? You got a scale. Because I need a special scale. I said, why is that? He tosses an ounce of cocaine in the flat. And, you know, he goes, take one in this golf ball size rock. And I take it, of course, and lose my mind completely. And, you know, and then he comes and asks me for the cash. And I, you know, you son of a bitch, you know, you don't do that to me again, I'll kill you. And then they go to my friend, who was my partner, and say, Mark, or Rit, or Hutch, Mark owes these guys big money for cocaine, and they're going to kill him, but they kind of need a new connection. If you could set this up, that they're willing to squash Mark's debt. Well, when they would call me on the phone, the cops, I'd go, hello, they would start to talk, I'd click, they must have had 1,000 of those, click, I wouldn't talk. Hutch, he talked, he did things. Anyway, we got set up. And it was a big setup. We were interviewed on KGNU over at a public radio station in Boulder. This is like during Reagan's drug war bullshit. And when I got on the stand, you know, they're accusing me of all this stuff, selling 2 ounces of cocaine to this undercover cop. And at the time, that was a mandatory 4 years per ounce.
Hmm.
And I got up on the stand. My lawyer asked me one question. He said, where were you, Mark, on the state these officers say you did this? I said, well, I was incarcerated in the Gunnison County Jail for driving without insurance for 10 days. And he looked over at the judge. I said, Your Honor, they're lying. And it was like, boom. You know, this trial, I walk out and I get basically for conspiracy. You know, you can't win. You just can't win. And my buddy, who they destroyed, who was like 6 months away from a triple degree at CU, did 6 years in prison.
Hmm.
Then did more because we were like sending him acid so he could like, write it out, but he made the mistake of sharing it with a cellmate and who snitched him out.
Hmm.
And so, you know, the drug war, there's so many casualties, so many casualties. And so many people have been hurt by it. And we've got to end it. We've got to end it. Like I said, the model of Portugal is there. You know, like, why can't we just open our eyes, you know? Is it? And again, I think it's because law enforcement makes way too much money off of it. Seizures, cash, all that kind of crap. Same with the DEA, you know? Of course, the cartels are making big cash off of it, who are also, you know, bribing law enforcement. Yeah. You know, it's a big game, man. It's a big game. And you know, anybody that's ever been in it knows that.
Yeah, it's hard to shut down you can't just shut down Walmart by saying they sell bad stuff. You know, they got a team of attorneys, and you could argue that the drug war is the biggest multinational corporation on the planet. Like, you know, how do you shut them down? They own everything. And when push comes to shove and there's no money for a state legislature, who do you think's funding them? Who do you think funds the bank bailout? Like, who do you think funds the initiatives around the world is the cartels. It's the American cartel, the Mexican cartel, the banking cartel. Like, it's all part of the same system, man.
And they are the ones, the cartels are the ones that taught the billionaires in America how to dodge taxes down in Panama. Basically offshore accounts, all that kind of crap, hiding their money everywhere, you know? And that's the problem, you know, that these people are so greedy, they don't want to pay their fair share. And they made all this money using our common, the public commons, you know, our roadways, our infrastructure, all these things we paid for. That's how they made their cash. But they're not willing to give it back, you know, to help improve that infrastructure so other people can lift themselves up also. And it's a real problem. It's a real problem.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about it. Wouldn't it be interesting, like, if you do legalize it, if you take a Portugal model, all of a sudden you take these people that are criminals and you just make them businessmen. Like, you know, why can't MS-13 be the next Steve Jobs? Like, they are. Like, these people have, if we just for a moment take them out of the world of criminality, like, those people, there's some really good entrepreneurs in there, you know?
Well, no, they're brilliant. They're
brilliant. Totally.
There's no doubt about that. One of my old connections told me once, he said, Mark, don't worry about it. You know, once you've made a lot of money, you can make it again because you already done it. So, you know, it can be done. For most people, they don't believe it can be done, you know? And I think a lot of times people are afraid to try for the fear of failing. And I think trying and failing is learning.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's part of life, man. And I
think that that's a huge point, and it takes us full circle almost. Just this, maybe the epidemic that we're all suffering from is fear. It's something that we're conditioned to. It's something that that's the reason why police act the way they do. It's the reason why, you know, criminals act the way they do. It's the reason I act the way I, it's the reason we all act in a certain way that is detrimental to our health is because we're afraid, we're being threatened. But the only thing, you know, I think it was JFK who said, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself. And if you can rise above it, it's difficult to speak truth to power. But if you can just begin to take one step towards that which you're afraid of, pretty soon you'll be face to face with it. And pretty soon you'll see that, hey, I don't really have that much to be afraid of because I got nothing to hide. You got nothing to hide. You got nothing to fear.
That's right. And what once you open up and let everybody know that your history, you know, it's over.
Yeah.
You know, who cares? I'm me. And as far as speaking truth to power, it has to be done.
It has to be done.
I'm doing it currently with Boulder County Housing Authority because they're abusing the disabled, the elderly, and the working poor by just lack of maintenance and craziness and seven layers of bureaucracy till I could get to the top till somebody made a decision. The only way I could get there, the only reason I got there is because I had connections. You know, I know Jonah Goose. I know Claire Levy. I've met Jared Polis. You know, I've got connections, and that's the only reason. Otherwise, I would have been evicted and thrown out on the street. And that's the reality poor people live on. Is if they speak up, they're going to get thrown away.
Yeah.
And that's why we have so many people on the street. And imagine living in a place where noises are happening constantly. So you got these constant sleep disturbances, right? As a registered sleep tech, I can tell you that is very bad for your brain, very bad for your physical health, your mental health, it will kill you. And the problem is, what will happen is you'll create a sleep deficit. And your brain doesn't care when it reaches that deficit. It will shut you off. you might be sitting in your chair. You might be doing 60 miles an hour down the highway. It will shut you down. And that's why we have auto, you know, that's a big cause for auto accidents, that sort of thing. And, you know, and these poor people, you know, they're getting driven insane because of their environment, you know? And we have the money to make it better. I mean, come on, you know, all this infrastructure money that's coming in, that was my point to Boulder County. It's like all this infrastructure money coming in. Shouldn't you guys get your house together before you start spending it? You know, because seriously, I think a lot of money gets wasted. And I'm not like a conservative. But I'm a realist. I was a delegate for Bernie Sanders. You know, I truly believe in that. With all my might. But there's common sense, and that's why I support Bernie, because he has common sense. You know, and I'm so glad that people have finally opened up to him. What he's been saying for freaking 40 years, you know, 40 years. And finally people are getting it. Thank God.
Yeah. As we're kind of coming up, getting ready to land the plane, Mark, like what would you say to like a younger George or a younger Mark, like who's kind of coming up and seeing these changes happen? Like, what advice would you give to your younger self? If there's like a younger version of us out there, what kind of words of wisdom would you give them they could hang on to?
Be true to yourself. Don't get hung up on what other people are telling you or saying about you, whatever. You know, don't get so hung up on like image, chasing money. Although we need it to live and be comfortable, don't become addicted to it, because that's what billionaires are. They're addicted to money. And, there's good and bad drugs out there. Be careful. Be careful. Before you experiment with anything, do research, you know. And know you're ready, you know, and set and setting again, but don't go into it haphazardly and don't abuse it. Cause man, let me tell you, I've been through it. Addiction, it's no fun. It's hell on you, your family, your friends. It's hell on everyone. It's hell on the country. And, it's just got to stop. And so please, please, you know, heed my words. Don't do opiates. Don't do fentanyl. Don't do methamphetamine. None of that crap. You know, if you want to have a real experience, take a mushroom. You know, seriously.
Man, just mic drop right there. That was beautiful. It's words of wisdom from a lived experience. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope everybody out there who listened to this enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, as much as Mark did. I got your Substack link down below. Is there any other place you want to send people to if they want to find out more about what you got going on?
Well, I do have a page on Facebook called Psychonautical Engineering. Okay. Otherwise, you know, I'm on LinkedIn. And I do have a Substack. I also write on the Daily Coast a lot about psychedelics and other things. I've gone through some stuff the last 5 months, you know, dealing with things. So I couldn't create a lot of content that I usually did, but I'm back on track now. So I'm looking forward to putting some more stuff out.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward for to be reading it and checking it out and further conversations with you. Looking forward to seeing any and all things that come up. And I'm really thankful that you're out there, Mark, doing what you're doing. I think that you leave a trail of breadcrumbs for activists to follow, and not only follow, but learn from some of the wins and some of the losses that you had. And that's really incredible that you're willing to share that. I think that's how people get better. And I'm thankful to get to see and be part of that experience, man. So thank you for your time here today.
You're welcome, my friend. And aloha.
Yeah. Hang on one second, Mark. I'm going to hang up with the people, but I wanted to chit chat for you one more. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for today. I hope everyone's having a beautiful day. I hope you heed the words of wisdom from Mark Rose. And that's all we got for today. Aloha. Aloha, everyone. Thanks for taking a moment to hang out with me in the True Life Podcast. I truly appreciate it. If you're taking some time to listen to this, whether it's your first podcast with me or you've been with me the whole way, I truly want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. Additionally, I would like to try to inspire everyone. The world is a crazy place, and if you listen to your heart and you take some chances, I really think the world will unfold in front of you in ways you can't imagine. I've been doing the podcast for about 5 years. Last year, I decided to take the plunge. Well, circumstances dictated that I took the plunge, and I did. I've begun working on the podcast full-time for almost a year now, and it's been so rewarding to me that I just want to try and inspire other people. If you have a dream, if you have a vision, follow the voice in your heart, listen to the song on the wind, and embrace the challenge. I think you're strong enough, you're smart enough, and you're good enough to make your dreams come true, but you have to believe in them. And I truly believe wholeheartedly that if you take a chance, a real chance on what is possible, then your dreams will unfold in front of you. Uncertainty can be a monster. It can be something that we run away from. But much like fear, if you stand in front of it, it's not that big of a problem. I know everyone listening to this has a dream and a vision, and I hope you all conquer it. And I want you to know it's possible. Take baby steps and move towards it, and you will get closer to it. Your relationships will be better. Your life will be better. And you know what? You deserve it. You're an amazing person. If you get a moment, go down to the show notes. If you can, support the show. Thank you so much for being here. Now let's get to it.